Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening interview, one of our most celebrated regional authors, Kathleen Stocking, will be here to read from her new book, The Long Arc of the Universe. Then I'll talk with crime writer Steve Hamilton about the first book of his new series, The Second Life of Nick Mason. At the end, I'll have a conversation with the 2016 Michigan Writers Chapbook winner, Gail Bozzano. Kathleen Stocking is here. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you.
And last time we saw you across microphones was about 14 years ago. We were talking about Letters from Leelanau and the Lake Country. Those first two books, Letters from Leelanau, was really about Leelanau County and a very close look at Leelanau County at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And your second book, Lake Country, sort of across the state.
Yeah, Ann Arbor was about the farthest south that I went. And then I went to many islands, Beaver Island, Mackinac Island, and in the Upper Peninsula.
Yes. And this book, The Long Arc of the Universe, it's sort of the completion of a trilogy. This is mm-hmm. the arc from something very local mm-hmm. to the greater world.
Mm-hmm.
The essays cover 16 or more years?
Yeah, more or less.
And this book, one of the major themes in it is about literacy or the lack of literacy and the effects of literacy to empower people and also to mm-hmm. enable democracy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, you first address this theme in the opening section of the book with two long essays, Soledad and San Francisco Jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure most of our listeners know that more than 2 million Americans are incarcerated. That's mm-hmm. about 0.91% of the population.
Right.
They're out of sight. Few of us know anything about their world. Would you tell our listeners about your experiences teaching writing in the prison system, what you learned?
Well, I learned that there are people just like us. I mean, everybody is a human being. And our prison system does not do a lot with rehabilitation. It's spotty. In some places, there's more. The San Francisco jail had a great program for rehabilitation, but writing was part of that, and everyone can benefit from it.
Could you talk about those writing classes?
The writing classes were intensely invested, especially at Soledad, because that's a state prison with about 6,000 inmates, and I had the best of 6,000. And I had been told by my friend Lou Capra in Leelanau County, she had taught in the prisons, that it would be some of the best teaching that, you know, you could find. And it was. It was greatly rewarding because they were eager for learning. One of the pieces of writing that I brought in was Jonathan Swift's essay about Ireland during the famine. And he was suggesting, tongue-in-cheek, but my students didn't know that, that children be raised for food.
Yes, a modest proposal.
A modest proposal, right. And when we were done reading it, there was absolute silence in the room. And I soon realized that they had not seen this as satire, but that it was real. And one of my students who was, how would I describe him? Like a coiled snake. He was just all tension and lethal ability to strike and a very, very scary person, but a very smart person. And he finally had the courage to speak for everybody, and he said that the modest proposal was some cold thinking. That's when I realized they thought it was real, and I explained satire, and I explained how angry Jonathan Swift had been at the British that they could let the children starve. And so he had suggested, oh, it'll solve lots of problems. You know, we'll have income, we'll have food, we'll raise the children to eat them. And I think that these students, for the most part, had not been exposed to ideas. Their lives had been pretty physical. Probably prison was the first time that they had a chance to stop and learn to read and learn to write. And so ideas were new to them. They were especially interested in Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is all about power relationships, and their lives in the prisons and jails were too. And also, I think they'd heard of Shakespeare, as we all have, and they kind of felt, well, everybody knows about this but us. So they were very eager to, we would act out some of the, you know, little pieces from Shakespeare, and they liked that.
So the data suggests that 75% or more of the people who are imprisoned are functionally illiterate.
Mm-hmm.
How do you overcome that teaching a writing class?
Ooh. Well, it wasn't true at Soledad because my students there were literate. However, at the San Francisco jail, where I taught in the Resolve to Stop the Violence program, they had, like, at best, a second grade education. And how I overcame it was I related to them as adults with adult issues, but recognizing that their skills were limited, I simply encouraged them. And also, when they would write something, I would take it home and type it up so it looked more presentable to them. And also, sometimes I took dictation. Mm-hmm. They would tell me a story and I would write it down. Or some of the people in there had more skills and they would take dictation, so that everybody had a chance to express a story. And it was actually, it was NPR in San Francisco who came and taped the men at the end of the time, at the end of May. And it was aired on NPR, reading their stories. And you know that writing is so empowering. And I just, I never emphasized weaknesses. And in every person, there would be some source of health or strength. And I would work outward from that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Everyone has a story, but some of us don't have the capacity to write it down.
Yeah, yeah. But that was really the least of it, Aaron. It was more about giving them confidence and honoring the spirit inside of them. That was a very unusual thing for them, because mostly they were not proud of who they were.
So the next prison you went to in San Francisco was perhaps more enlightened? And
their program was wonderful. They had a guy who was in charge of the jail programs, who himself had been in prison. And the sheriff in San Francisco really believed in, I think his name was Hennessy, believed in rehabilitation, and it was a great place to work. It was a wonderful place to work.
So you moved from the prison systems,
mm-hmm,
to a private school in El Salvador,
mm-hmm,
and the school is a place that caters to the children of the wealthiest, most powerful people in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the school grounds are a tiny island of privilege in a, mm-hmm, sea of poverty,
mm-hmm,
and you as a teacher,
mm-hmm,
are almost imprisoned by the situation.
Yeah, it was definitely a golden cage. It was a terrifying place because the ruling oligarchs were doing some things that probably human beings never should. And their children were still children, but they almost wanted them not to be able to analyze or think about anything. It was a very restricted educational environment. They wanted them to learn English, so I focused on vocabulary. But if we ever veered toward real emotion, real thinking, trying to deeply understand things, I could feel it would come through the students from their parents that they really didn't want that. They kept asking for grammar all the time. That's the first thing fascists want. Because it seems really cut and dried. But of course, any English teacher, any writer knows that grammar is pretty difficult. So I really pretended to teach grammar to satisfy them. And I pretended to do what they wanted, but also engaged my students.
And part of doing what they wanted was that every child had to attain at least a B, regardless of their...
Well, presumably I could have given a grade lower than a B, but I had heard that the person I replaced had been hit by a, quote, stray bullet for giving someone a C. And I thought, well, I'm not going to die. I'll just give nothing lower than a B. So which is easy to do. You just structure your grade on a curve. You know, you just mm-hmm. structure everything in such a way that you don't give low grades, because I was there to teach as much as I could. I wasn't there to risk my life.
Now, you moved from that school to several other schools along the way, but you also moved to becoming a Peace Corpsman.
Yeah, I did that. I went into the Peace Corps in Thailand in, I can't remember, 2006, 2007. And then each time I left, I would come back here. So I went to Thailand, I came back to Leelanau County, and then I went to Romania in the Peace Corps as well.
And when you were in Thailand, you were dealing with refugees from Burma.
Well, by my choice. Yes. I was in rural schools in Thailand through the Peace Corps, but because my niece had worked in the refugee camps with Burmese refugees, I went and did that on my vacation.
And that's so interesting, because in this country, we've been hearing about Syria and North Africa and the mm-hmm. refugees coming to Europe. Mm-hmm. But there are refugee problems all over the world.
All over the world.
Mm-hmm. And you confronted one of them.
Mm-hmm. People are just people everywhere. There we did fairy tales and acted them out. The Burmese in the refugee camps were often very literate, and English was their second language. Some of the people in the refugee camps had been there for 30 years. So, and they got classes the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, you move to Romania, and you are teaching in a Romanian school, but the last vestiges of the Soviet system still exist.
Yeah, I think that was my experience in any case, that the communists who had left in 1989, more or less, it took a while for everything to transition. But, you know, before the communists in Romania, the peasants were not educated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the Russians who brought all the people in from the fields into the cities, and the parents were often employed in factories, and the children were sent to school. But it was a very structured educational system, rote learning. And
they wanted them to read,
mm-hmm.
but there was no tradition of teaching writing.
Oh, absolutely none. No. And again, you know, writing and thinking are very American and really democratic. It's about free expression.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working with these kids, I realized that I couldn't help but anticipate from them an expression of thoughts and feelings. And it was because I grew up here. and I think people naturally want to express. And they were kids.
Yes.
And nobody had told them they couldn't. So they were doing it. And I think that what has happened with the internet is a worldwide renaissance. Just like the printing press democratized everything, I think the internet has too. And, you know, even in the places where the kids didn't go to school, they could teach themselves how to read from the keyboards. There would always be, even sometimes just in someone's house, a computer and a keyboard. And they were learning to read just like people probably did after the printing press. Because before that, you'd go to a scribe.
Yes.
There was no reason to learn how to do something you didn't need to use very often. Like, I don't know how to do an oil and filter change, and I don't really want to learn because I can pay someone to do that. It was the same before the printing press. There weren't books. So now with the internet, I think we're going to go to global democracy. I think that all the upheaval we're seeing, all the terrorism, is the extremes that are normal when you have so much change, cataclysmic change. In the time I was traveling where the internet, it didn't exist when I started out, and it was, you know, full force by the time I came home, it's changing everything.
So at the end of the book, you have an essay, My Country. Could I get you to read a few pages?
Sure, Aaron. I would love to. Thank you. You don't really know where you're from until you've been somewhere else and come back. That's because anything is only itself in relationship to some other thing. A day is only a day in relationship to the night. An apple stands for every fruit until you've tasted a mangosteen. America isn't America until you've been to El Salvador. Growing up above Sleeping Bear Bay, I had some gut-level love of country that was mostly inarticulate and incoherent, the way you love a new puppy. My love of America had something to do with the beauty of Lake Michigan from the top of the dunes and the man who ran the barber shop in Empire, Mr. Lamkin, who did not know me except as a reckless 9-year-old out on horseback in a pelting April rain, who lifted me from my horse and put me into his old blue boiled wool World War II sweater to ride back to Glen Arbor. The sweater weighed like iron, and he must have thought, if nothing else, it would anchor me to the saddle. He said I could bring the sweater back sometime. My childhood was lucky, with a freedom that in retrospect was unusual. I could go anywhere, anytime, and I did. I played in the ice caves alone. I read in the barn loft, thrilling to the sound of the rain on the tin roof and the lightning and thunder outside. The hidden, fragrant arbutus under its rust-spotted, leathery leaves, when the snow was barely melted, was magical since I discovered it when I was alone. I can still call up the taste of wild strawberries in the spring and the days picking them in the hills above the bay after the ice had melted, the wind off the water smelling like fresh-cut cucumbers. People talk about the horrifying poverty in third-world countries, but it's not the poverty that's scary. It's the lack of easy talking and thinking. The United States has all too often been complicit, unfortunately, with tyrants and bad governments. We seem to like freedom at home, but to like dictators everywhere else, perhaps because they're easier to control. Walt Whitman figured it out, and he didn't even have to leave the country to do it. "This, then, is what you shall do," he wrote. "Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Give alms to everyone who asks. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Despise riches. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Go freely with powerful, uneducated persons and with the young and with the mothers of families. I love my country, and I'm not ashamed to say that."
Kathleen Stocking, reading from The Long Arc of the Universe. Kathleen, your books are available everywhere regionally and on the internet everywhere. Your website is
KathleenStockingBooks.com.
Thank you so much for being here, and we hope to see you again in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you. I'm delighted to welcome Steve Hamilton to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Steve Hamilton is the New York Times bestselling author of 13 novels, and today we'll be talking on the phone with Steve, who is coming to the end of a national tour for his newest title, The Second Life of Nick Mason. By my count, you've done about 28 cities in 30 days, something like that?
I think it's. I think that's it. I'm on number 26 or 27. It's been a long ride, but it's. Everybody's been so great, so I'm really happy to be doing this.
Well, a lot of our listeners will know that you grew up in Metro Detroit and attended the University of Michigan. And while you were an undergraduate, you won the prestigious Hopwood Award for writing. But I was interested to learn that you weren't an English major.
I actually wasn't. I was a computer science major. This is back in the early 80s when, the economy obviously isn't that great in Michigan or really anywhere now, and it was really bad, too, back in the 80s. And it was just a practical choice back then. It's like, I always knew I was a writer, and I was going to be a writer. There was no stopping me with that. And I took a ton of writing classes at Michigan and, creative writing and had some great experiences with that. But part of my sort of job being at school was to start a career somewhere so that I could have that as well.
And you started a career with IBM as a technical writer.
Yeah, and I ended up staying with them for 30 years, actually. I really sort of led a double life for a long time there. I wrote 12 books doing that, even though I was working full-time and I had a family by then, and I was, working all day, going home at night. After everybody went to bed, that's when I would do my writing.
So how long did it take you to get back to fiction after you started the career at IBM?
It took a little while because nobody's making you do it. There's nobody cares if you're writing or not other than you. And it's easy to get wrapped up in a new career and, one day goes by and then another, and it's really easy to forget that promise that you made to yourself. And years did go by when I was not keeping that promise. And I met someone at work who was a member of a writing group. And that was what I needed to get back to that promise, because now I had this sort of structure and this expectation, because every Thursday night, they'd be waiting for me in the basement of that library on the other side of the river. And now I had this little deadline. I had people waiting and expecting. So that's what I needed to get back to it.
And you stayed with that writing group for a lot of years.
I did. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to see two of those guys tomorrow. We still have lunch, very often. And I still read their stuff that they're working on. And they sometimes read my stuff, too. It's a little different now because I'm, a lot of traveling and a lot of other stuff. But I still absolutely keep in contact with them.
Before we discuss your new title, The Second Life of Nick Mason, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about your Alec McKnight books. This series garnered both critical acclaim and a huge following. The McKnight stories resonate with so many of us, his years as a Detroit cop and then running away to the UP to seek solace of sorts because he ends up battling in good and evil again. Over those 10 books, how did that character grow and change? Did you know him in the beginning, or did it all
it's funny how that. I was new to novel length fiction then, and that first book was really just my attempt to write a crime novel, and I wanted to write a private eye novel, because I loved reading that growing up, and I tried to have. I tried to create this private eye who was sitting in the office in a city somewhere, which is where private eyes are, and have the client come in and have the wisecracks and, everything that makes a private eye novel work. And you can still do some great stuff with that, by the way. But I just couldn't do it. And I ended up just trying something for the heck of it, totally different. I said, what if my ex-cop was sort of checked out a little bit and he was in the most remote place that I could think of, which for me and for most people who live in Michigan, it's pretty easy to imagine where you'd go if you wanted to get away from everything in your life. You'd just drive straight north and you'd cross that bridge. And you'd go to this place up there, which is unlike anything else in, you know, that you've ever been. There's just something about the Upper Peninsula that is, it can be very lonely, it can be very desolate, it can be very harsh, obviously, in the wintertime. But during the summer, that brief, very, very brief summer they have up there, I think it's the most beautiful place on the earth.
I certainly agree with that. Did you have any idea when you wrote that first book that this whole series would happen? Was there just the slightest hint?
I really didn't, no. I mean, I was just, like I said, I was trying to find that first book, and I found Alex sort of in that cabin, and I just started trying to find out what had happened to him that he would end up there. And really that first book was just answering those questions. Why is he here? And now that he's here, you know, whatever he's tried to get away from, has he gone far enough for it not to be able to find him? And of course the answer is no, because even if you go to a town called Paradise, which, you know, which is a real place, by the way.
Yes, I've been there.
As you know, I go to other parts of the country, they don't realize that it really is a little town called Paradise. But the whole point of that story is that you can go to that place like that, and the trouble from your past can still find you there.
Given the success of that series, what influenced you to create a new series, the Nick Mason, well, Darius
yeah,
Cole?
I had done, you know, I wrote 10 books in that series, and there was one point after doing 7 where I felt like it was time to do something different, and that's when I wrote a book called The Lock Artist, which is a very different kind of book with a young character, with someone who's more or less on the other side of the law, even if he sort of gets pulled into it, and a character who doesn't talk, too, by the way. So that was a very, very different kind of writing experience, but it was, and it was a lot harder than I thought it would be. But it was, you know, I never regret for a second that I took that big journey to find that book, because I came back to the McKnight series, and I think I was a much better writer then. And I did 3 more books in that series, and then it just felt like it was time to try something new again. As a writer, you always want to be challenging yourself. You never want it to get easy. You never want to just turn the crank for the next one. So I took another break, and I tried to do something really, really different. And with this character who doesn't have a lot in common on paper with Alex McKnight. He's a career criminal, for one thing. And to put yourself just in his shoes for a second, if you imagine, you know, you're doing federal time in a maximum security prison, and you're not going to get out for a very long time. And somebody makes you this offer that will get you out and will let you see your family again. That's an offer you have to take. And not only do you get out, the next day you find yourself in this amazing new life with living in this luxury condo and driving this amazing car, and you have money every month, you have everything a man could want, but the cost of that is that you have to answer the phone and do whatever you're told to do, no matter what it is, no matter what crime you have to commit, no matter what horrible thing you never thought you'd do, you have to do it, because that's the deal that you made, and there's no way out of it.
Yeah, it's a great setup. The reader is grabbed immediately. And you leave Paradise for Chicago.
Chicago is the setting of this new book. And it just felt like, as I was starting to get to know this character, Nick Mason, it felt like he would come from a place like Chicago. And specifically, he would come from the South Side, which is a world of its own, really. And when he came back, he'd come back to Chicago, but he'd come back to a part of Chicago that he didn't know, which is the North Side, which is Lincoln Park, specifically, this you know, this amazing place right on the lake, and this condo. So it's a strange sort of homecoming, in that he doesn't even recognize where he is now. Chicago's a big enough place where you can do that, and it is a city that has different worlds in it. And I was just there last week, and I was reminded just how amazing and beautiful that city is, and at the same time, how, you know, they had 69 people shot over the weekend. There was a heartbreaking tradition, ongoing history of violence and corruption there that goes all the way back to Al Capone, and they just can't seem to shake it.
Well, the corruption's an important part of this book. You talk about the special investigations section of a group of elite policemen who sort of can do what they want.
Yeah, that's pardon me. That's really, those are sort of ironically the worst people in this book are a bunch of cops who are given this authority and just turn it into this terrible situation where they're doing anything that they want. And when I was researching the history of Chicago itself, it's kind of amazing how you don't go far back into history and you find a group of cops who were just like this, and they were called SOS. Special Operations Section. They operated in the 90s into the 2000s, and they were given the same kind of authority to go anywhere they want, just take drugs and guns off the street. And some of the stuff that they ended up doing, you know, with no oversight and no responsibility, they just, by the end, they were kidnapping suspects, torturing them, taking them back to their houses, and stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars. There was one of the ringleaders towards the end, he actually was going to put out a contract hit on another cop who was going to cooperate with the investigation that finally brought them down. So, I mean, it's this kind of stuff you can't make up, you know. As a crime writer, you just marvel at that this stuff really happens. But in a book, at least you get to make everybody pay for it, you know. And in real life, it doesn't always work that way.
Now, is this going to be a series, or
this is absolutely a series. I'm into the second book now. I think I really learned a lot about writing a series from sort of making my way through the McKnight series, and I have a much better idea up front where this is going to go. I really sort of have 7 books kind of laid out now already.
Wow!
And if you think about the situation that he's in, being on call 24/7 and having to do what he's told, it could really take him anywhere. And it's going to take them everywhere. It's going to just go, and people, some of the characters that you think are enemies will become allies and vice versa, and it's just going to be a wild ride. And at some point, it'll be a lot of fun to have Nick Mason and Alex McKnight in the same book.
Ah, that's interesting. Now, I'm sure you've gotten lots of emails from your readers wondering when the next Alex McKnight book is going to come out.
Yeah, actually, when I get back home, I'll be a couple more days, and I'm going to turn in Alex number 11. So I'm definitely, absolutely, always want to go back to Alex and see what he's up to. And I think this one will be the best one yet. And I'm going to be doing both.
Now, The Second Life of Nick Mason has been optioned as a film. Are you involved in that process?
To some extent. I mean, really, it's a matter of having the right people doing it. It's Lionsgate has this book. I know they're going to do a great job. It's set in an amazing place, and this character is some, you know, if you just get this character, I think it's going to be a really good movie. And, you know, it's the first time I've ever had a book turned into a movie. So I'm just excited, and it's just going to be fun. I'm just going to enjoy it. It's going to be a blast just to see it happen and to, you know, go to the premiere. And I'm going to enjoy bringing the movie to Michigan and sort of having some events here and there, you know, in local theaters. That'll really be a lot of fun.
Oh, that'll be terrific. Look forward to that. Last August, you made headlines when you left your long-term publisher, St. Martin's, and moved to Putnam. And part of the process was also changing agents. An author of one of the articles I read threw in a waggish comment about, is this the second life of Steve Hamilton as well?
Yeah, it's funny how the title sort of fed into that whole idea.
Those of us at great distance from New York, what is this all about?
Well, first of all, my agent was getting ready to retire, so I'd already had a new agent, Shane. So we were already working together. And after doing 12 books with St. Martin's, this book really felt like it was really, really important to me. And I really believed in it. And I really believe this is the one book that was going to let me be a full-time writer, finally, you know, after 30 years at IBM and always wanting to do that. So I'd actually left my job at that point. And I had told them, you know, we're going to do this with St. Martin's Press. Because it's kind of, being with them for so long, there were so many writers who had asked me why I was still there. Because everybody sort of starts with them and then they all leave. You know, there are so many authors who have done that. And I was the one who stayed loyal. And I was the one who stuck with them and wrote 12 books for them and won a couple Edgars and everything else and sold a million copies of books. And I believed that they were going to finally break this book out and do something really amazing with this book and with this new series. And they had made all these promises. And we got so close to that book. It was supposed to be out last fall. And we were actually 60 days away from that date, and they were just about to print the books. I mean, they were going to run the presses the next day. And we finally saw the marketing plan, and we finally were so devastated by the fact that just they weren't going to do anything differently. The promises weren't going to be kept. And it just felt like this big chance, this book that we believed in so much was just going to go out there and just die. I mean, there's no other way to put it. And it was the most just devastating and terrifying experience when we realized we just have to leave. We have to walk away. And we bought back the contract. And we left. And they told us that was, you know, it was the biggest mistake of my life, and I just ended my career. But sometimes you just have to do something like that. I mean, this was the one book where I felt like I just had to. And it was supposed to be quiet and respectful when we finally did agree on the terms to leave. But they sort of took a shot on the way out and released a statement that we had to correct. And the next thing I know, it really kind of blew up and it sort of touched a nerve throughout the whole industry. And that's how it became such big news. And it was just overwhelming, all the response that I got from other authors who had sort of gone through the same thing or could imagine going through the same thing. Or sort of stuck where they were and didn't have the same chance to leave. By the next day, we had offers from 10 other publishers. And by that night, we had agreed on a new deal with Putnam. And that's why this book is out now with a much nicer cover and with really my first real national book tour I've ever gone on, which is why I'm sitting in this hotel looking out at a nice day in Boston. And it's just been an amazing experience to finally come through on the other side of this and to have this book released finally, to have all the amazing response that it's had. And to have Stephen, to wake up and have Stephen King tweet that, trust Stephen King, this book is the real deal. I mean, that was just like an amazing day because we didn't even know that he had the book. I mean, we didn't send it to him.
Which is the top blurb on the back of the book.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, thanks, Stephen. You know, it's like, it just turned into this just amazing experience, like I said. And I can't believe it all happened. And I can't believe that I'm finally here at this point in my life where I really am a full-time writer, like I always wanted to be.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. So much. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Oh, sure. Sure.
And I want to call our listeners' attention to your website because it's a very complete, beautiful website. It is?
The website is authorstevehamilton.com. It's A-U-T-H-O-R, stevehamilton.com. And I'm also on, you can tweet me at authorsteve, and you can find me on Facebook at stevehamiltonauthor. As well. So, I mean, and I love hearing from people, and I always try to write back. So please drop me a line.
The book, again, is The Second Life of Nick Mason. It is a terrific read. I could not put it down. Steve Hamilton, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Since 2005, Michigan Writers, a Traverse City-based organization, has sponsored a chapbook competition to help emerging writers publish their first book. The winners of the competition share in much of the work of producing these chapbooks. They are also responsible for most of the marketing. The winner of the 2016 Michigan Writers Chapbook Competition is Gail Wallace Bazzano, and she is here today with me in the studio. Welcome, Gail.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Gail lives in Northbrook, Illinois, and she studied journalism at the University of Illinois and creative writing at Columbia College, Chicago. And along the way, you spent years as a journalist.
I did. I worked for 7 years, roughly, as a newspaper reporter and editor, and that's really where I learned how to work on a deadline and just bang stories out quickly. But I even back in those days, I always wanted to write more creatively, fiction and creative nonfiction. So eventually, I found my way to that.
And instead of working now, much of your time is consumed with.
Well, I would say that I still work. I just don't get paid for anything I do. I have 3 children who are all still at home. I have a 17-year-old that just turned 13-year-old and an almost 10-year-old. So they keep me very busy. I feel very fortunate that we are able to get by on one income. So when I'm not busy with my children, I'm able to focus on my creative work. So I'm very grateful for that.
And your book is titled, or I should say your chapbook is titled, Supposing She Dreamed This. Could you tell our listeners exactly what a chapbook is?
Well, a chapbook is a chapter book. It's a small book. If you look at it, it's quite thin. The story is about 10,000 words, so it's not quite a novella, but it is a long short story is probably the best way to describe it.
Would you talk about this book? Is this a new story? Is this something you worked on for years? How did this come about?
I've had the idea in my head for years. I have a son who's on the autism spectrum and has some other disabilities. So part of the story came out of my personal experience, and part of it just came out of my imagination, and part of it came out of an experience we actually had with a tree in our backyard. I will read part of the story that has to do with that issue. And I've been attending the Interlaken Writers Retreat. This is my 7th year coming to the retreat. And I started a scene that became sort of one of the pivotal moments in the story was started in a fiction workshop up here at Interlaken. So it was very gratifying for me to sort of see the project come full circle and be able to read it at the Writing House this past Sunday, where the story first came into being, at least part of it did. So that was a lot of fun for me.
So your early drafts, what were we talking about in length?
Oh, man, I don't know. I go through so many drafts and I don't keep track of pages. I get frustrated with my own creative process because as a journalist, I got used to just banging things out very quickly, as I said. And this process is very slow and laborious, and there's parts of that I enjoy. But then when I look at the amount of time it takes me to finish a project, I always wish I could work quicker, but in the end, in this case anyway, the end result was worth it. And it took probably 3 years. I started it, at least I had the idea in my head 3 years ago.
Now, when your story was selected to be part of the Michigan Writers Cooperative Press, or to be the selection this year, what was the process then? You were working with editors here and...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I entered it back in December. Then I found out in March that I had won. And so that was very exciting. Then I was, I think pretty much right away, I was assigned an editor, John Paul, who was wonderful. And we communicated via email. And so he looked at the manuscript very carefully. And I was a little bit apprehensive because I didn't know. This is a first experience for me. So I didn't know if he was going to want to make a lot of changes or what that was going to look like. And in fact, he was very careful in what he suggested. And he told me that the work obviously had been already edited very thoroughly. I work with a writing coach, Katie Schultz, who is the creative director, artistic director of the Interlaken Writers Retreat. And she also runs a business of personal critiques and coaching for students. And I'm one of her students. I've been working with her for 4 years. So she and I have been working on this story. I've been sending her excerpts, usually 10 pages at a time, and starting out very rough and then sort of honing in on the fine details of the story. So by the time John saw it, a lot of work had already been put into it, and he said he could tell that. So that said, he did find places to improve it and hone it, and I'm very grateful for his keen eye in the stages of this.
Well, I can say, as a careful reader of the manuscript, it is very tight. It is beautifully crafted. It's an enormously powerful story. Could I get you to read a few pages of this story and, first of all, talk about it a bit?
Sure. So, without giving too much away, the protagonist is a woman in her late 30s named Katrina. She has a son who is on the autism spectrum and nonverbal. She's home with him. She and her husband are grappling with the issue of, do they have more children? She wants another child. Her husband does not. And in the midst of this, she notices that there is something wrong with her beloved maple tree in their backyard. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this. This is about 16 pages in. The arborist came 2 days later on a Tuesday. Katrina had just gotten home after picking up Ethan from school. She found the commute tiring, and it bothered her that the route took her right past the gleaming, newly renovated public elementary school just 4 blocks from their house. Ethan's small private school, geared towards children on the autism spectrum, was 8 miles away, a straight shot up the Tri-State Expressway. Now Ethan was settled in with the Thomas the Train video on his portable DVD player, and Katrina watched through the front window as an older woman shuffled up the walk. She wore brown corduroy slacks and a green sweatshirt. Her hair was hennaed a deep red, the color of a cherry Tootsie Pop. Katrina sighed. Ethan hadn't had a snack yet. He was good for maybe 15 minutes tops. She didn't have time to waste on some aging hippie tree hugger who would no doubt judge her for using a landscaping service that dumped non-organic fertilizer and herbicide onto the yard. Katrina would like to have an organic vegetable garden and a compost pile and a push mower instead of landscapers, but she was just too tired to go green. She stepped out the door before the woman could ring the doorbell. "I'm Terry," the woman said. She had a pleasant face, lightly lined. Katrina led her around the side of the house and through the gate. The maple dominated the east side of the yard, black limbs reaching skyward, the highest branches like fingers wrapped around a blue bowl of sky. Terry looked at it and shook her head. A warm breeze gusted and waned, and in the silence, Katrina heard another deep creak. "I'm not in the backyard every day," Katrina said. "But the other day, I heard the creaking and then saw the crack." She pointed to the biggest one, the one that seemed to cleave the tree into 3 parts. "Is there anything you can do to wire it together, help it heal?" Her voice trailed off, muffled by another gust of wind. Terry was looking not at the cracks, but at the ground. "Girdling root," she pronounced. "Girdling root?" Katrina repeated, baffled. "Some of the roots have started to grow around the stem. Look here, you can see it. And see how the trunk is flat on this side?" Terry ran gnarled fingers down the ridged gray-brown bark. drier than it had been on Sunday. The tree can't get enough water and nutrients. At this stage, there's nothing you can do. She straightened and looked right at Katrina. Her pale brown eyes were steady and kind. Katrina looked down. She could see it, the funnel-shaped base of the root beginning its clockwise spiral. She imagined the spiral continuing underground, strong as death. The tree is strangling itself? Why? She demanded. It had to be last summer's drought. She had known enough to let the grass wither and die and water the trees, but she hadn't stuck to a schedule. Her fault. And the weather was still out of whack. Today, the temperatures were pushing 80 degrees. The maple's deep brown buds were almost ready to burst open into lacy, greener-than-green catkins. Soon, the whole tree would look as joyous as a bird lifting its head, ready to burst into song. It would leaf a full month early. This just happens sometimes, Terry said. It started when the tree was very young, maybe when it was planted. Norway maples are prone to it. You should take it down soon, she added. Trees with girdling root go downhill very quickly, and yours is already rotting out. With the wind as strong as it's been, she shrugged. In the silence, Katrina could hear the brittle rattle of her neighbor's poplar branches and felt a warm gust like animal breath on her cheek, in her hair. The tree creaked again, low and deep. She stepped back and tugged at the strings on the gray sweatshirt she'd thrown on out of habit. Part of her couldn't believe she would have been comfortable today in shorts and a t-shirt. She tried to mentally subtract the maple from the landscape and failed. It was by far their biggest tree. Its limbs reached almost to the family room window. In the summertime, the deep shade from the green canopy created a large, bare patch of earth where no grass would grow. She loved to watch the bright yellow goldfinches swoop in for a meal on the thistle feeder and then dart back up among the leaves. In October, it all turned golden, pear-colored leaves stunning against black bark, the whole thing framed by the dining room window, its bright beauty reflected in gleaming hardwood floors. Last fall, she had taken Ethan out with her while she raked. She'd relaxed into the rhythm of the chore and the ripe earth smell, a smell of cinnamon and sunlight, and the yellow leaves drifting all around them. Ethan had spun in circles for a while and then plopped down and rested his back against the trunk. Next time she looked at him, he was putting a leaf in his mouth, and she had to drop the rake and coax him to spit out his prize. But she couldn't blame him for wanting to taste what looked and smelled so glorious. You could replace it with a native species, Terry was saying. People are doing that more now. I can give you some recommendations if you like. She was already walking away from the tree toward the gate that led to the front yard. She had to get to her next appointment, she said. She had a list of tree removal companies if Katrina could walk her to her car. But Katrina had to stop for a second while tears pooled in her lower eyelids. It was just a tree, she told herself. A non-native tree that never should have been here in the first place. A tree that was just plopped into the ground when the houses and the subdivision popped up 50 years ago. A tree that wrapped its own roots around its base and never gave itself a chance. If she was going to cry when she still had 6 hours to go before Ethan went to bed, let it be for something bigger. Kids starved and polar bears drowned, and millions of acres of precious old-growth forests went up in flames every single minute of every day. Cry about that, she told herself, or this. She would have no more children.
Gail Wallace Bozzano reading from her chapbook, Supposing She Dreamed This. So, Gail, now you have one piece of fiction in print. What's next?
Yes. Well, my hope is that the story in this chapbook will become part of a larger collection. The second story is finished, and I have others in various stages of I guess, drafts, mm-hmm. I'll say. One of the themes that I plan to link the collection is climate change. It's something I'm incredibly concerned about. And I think sometimes my journalistic instincts kick in, and I see this as the story of the millennium, really, in some ways. And I don't think it's being covered properly. And as a creative writer, it's just one of the things that I can't keep silent about. So I hope to get it into my work somehow.
Gail, you don't have a website yet, but if listeners want to know more about you, they can find you on Facebook at?
Gail Wallace Bazzano. Just look me up. I don't have a separate author Facebook page. It's my personal page and everything on there. So
good. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
For more information about the Traverse City-based organization, Michigan Writers, and the Michigan Writers Cooperative Press, please check out their website at www.mishwriters.org. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Kathleen Stocking, Steve Hamilton, and Gail Bazzano. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words. Thank you.